I'm Dean Olscher, sitting in for Leonard Lopate today. Just yesterday, Christopher Isherwood in the New York Times called him a theatrical plastic surgeon. His Playbill bio lists 19 musical adaptations for the Encore series. He is currently represented on Broadway in this adaptation of a play by Mark Twain, which remarkably had never been produced before. It surfaced in a filing cabinet at the University of California in Berkeley in 2002. Did I say Christopher Isherwood? Charles Isherwood is who it was. I'm not the first person to make that mistake.
I've been working with a dead author now for months.
Exactly. So anyway, when the producers of Is He Dead needed to adapt the Twain script for a contemporary audience, they turned to, again, in Charles Isherwood's words, the best cut and paste man in the business, and he is here. He is David Ives. Welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you very much.
So let us begin with a plot synopsis in 50 words or less. Go.
Plot synopsis. Is He Dead is the story of a painter, Jean-François Millet, who actually was a real painter.
Yes.
And very famous in Twain's time. He was dead. He actually was dead when Twain wrote the play. Very important point. We have to know who's dead and who's not dead.
In 1898.
In 1898, when Twain wrote the play.
Yes.
But Jean-François Millet was probably as famous then as Monet is now, and his paintings fetched astronomical prices.
Everybody knows the gleaners, the women who are bent over
picking up old manuscripts by Mark Twain. One of them is Shelley Fisher Fishkin, who discovered the manuscript, actually.
She's a scholar.
She's a scholar who found the manuscript, and she is the woman on the left.
This is way past 50 words.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Here's the plot synopsis. Jean-François Millet is a young painter in 1846 who owes a lot of money to a picture dealer. He is in love with a young woman whose father also owes even more money to the picture dealer. The picture dealer forecloses. He says, "Pay up or I will have you all jailed." Jean-François Millet and his painter friends, his wacky painter friends, decide that the only way that he's ever going to become rich and famous is to die. And so they concoct a plot whereby they will announce to the papers that he's deathly ill, and then 3 months later they'll kill him off. And in this time, his prices will skyrocket, yes, and he will become the painter that he wanted. The problem is that being dead, he cannot marry the girl of his dreams or do anything else.
Right.
And so they decide that he is going to come back as his own widowed sister.
Yes.
Complications ensue.
Yes.
Happy ending. I think that was
74. That was pretty good. So Mark Twain picks Millet. Why? What was it about Millet's story that was interesting with regard to Twain's own biography?
Well, to tell you the truth, when I started working on the play, when I first read it and our producers asked me to adapt it, I wanted to change it from Millet. I wanted to change it to Monet because I thought in Twain's own time, if the play had been done, everybody would know who this person was. In our own time, Monet has kind of taken his place. And my producer, Bob Boyette, was dubious about this, rightfully so, and said, "I don't know about that. Think about it." And as I thought about it, I realized how wrong I was, because I think what ties those two together is that Twain was the spokesman for the common man, and Jean-François Millet painted the common man. And so I'm sure that he saw in those paintings of Millet a kind of pictorial statement of something he'd been doing for the past 30 or 40 years.
A key point of Twain's biography at this point is that he had been bankrupt.
Not only bankrupt, but his daughter had died. His beloved daughter died, and he was in Vienna. And so he thought that he could make money in the theater, which only shows what a humorist Mark Twain actually was. He was funnier than we thought. I don't know any playwright who harbors that delusion, which only shows he was a novelist at heart, I guess.
But was he at all a good playwright?
Am I allowed to speak freely?
Yes, of course.
He was a wonderful writer, but not a natural playwright. And I'll tell you why, because his great gift was for storytelling. And to tell you the truth, playwriting is not about storytelling. Playwriting is about construction. And he loved that kind of languorous, shaggy dog sort of feeling. And shaggy dog plays always need to go to the trimmer and have their wool clipped, which was sort of what I had to do. I didn't realize I'd been called a theatrical plastic surgeon. I hate to think that I'm just responsible for the jowls of Mark Twain.
Well, you know, Isherwood refers to it as a nip and, not this in particular, but he calls it the work of nip and tuck, but it is a lot more than that. In the case of this play, there's injecting a certain amount of collagen, and then we have stretched that metaphor past its prime because there is a lot of you in this play.
I must admit I did insert myself into it. The Twain play, the original Twain play, is, when I read it, I thought it was absolutely wonderful because it contained not only one great comic idea, but two great comic ideas, faking the death, and on top of that, causing an even better complication with being coming back as one's own widowed sister. And, well, A Man in a Dress is as old as Aristophanes in 400 BC, but not a dead man in a dress. That's the, you know, that's the crucial missing point. And so when I read the play, I thought that there was such theatrical gold in here, but it was kind of buried under a lot of too many characters, not enough, in a funny way, not enough plot. And so I sort of took what is his third act and made it my second act and added a couple of subplots that keep under, that are sort of the substructure for the rest of the play.
And also language that seems very modern. I mean, I noticed a few things that went by that were not said in Twain's time. I don't think they bought in bulk, or you wouldn't say take them to the gleaners, which is a very funny but contemporary joke.
I must confess that I had to hide my signature in here somewhere. and so, yes, your X-ray eyes have found me out. I did stick that in there so that people would turn to each other and say, "I don't think Mark Twain wrote that." just to think of me for a minute. It's a narcissistic thing, but it's me.
Now, there was a scholarly enterprise at foot here too, and did that cause conflict? On the one hand, you have Professor Fishkin, right?
Shelley Fisher Fishkin, the discoverer of the manuscript.
Yes.
Shelley, most of my contact with Shelley actually was at the beginning of the process when I took it on, and she gave me thoughts on the play and on Mark Twain, and then I was sort of sent off to do what I do. I mean,
did she say, "Look, I'm sorry, you can't talk about pork barrel spending in your script"?
Oddly enough, I wanted to talk about pork barrel spending.
Well, you did.
I did. I slipped that in too. Yes, you've seen my signature all over this thing. But she didn't have so many caveats as a general one, which was to try to keep as much Twain as I could, which I did, and I wanted to do anyway. And so there are whole slathers of Twain in this, to use another of his favorite words in the play. That word is not mine. That is Twain. When you hit slathers, you know it's Twain.
Can you give us a concrete idea of the before and after?
The before of the play?
Yes. What did you work with and what did you turn it into?
I had a three-act play with probably 30 people on stage, and I made it into a two-act play with a cast of 11.
But just at the line of dialogue level, you know, what might you have changed so that you made it contemporary?
Well, I tried actually not to make it too contemporary because then there'd be too big a disconnect between what he wrote and I wrote. And so part of my job was really to read it over and over again until I kind of had the voices of these characters, which are wonderful. Mm. And I sort of had to pick which characters I wanted to deal with. It was like creating a board game in which someone's given you 20 pieces and you get to pick the ones you like and then move them around the board. And so having learned those pieces and learned their voices, I sort of had to do literary ventriloquism for a while and continue their voices, because I thought of my job as doing what Mark Twain would have done had he lived another 97 years and had a little more theatrical experience. I've had 97 years of theatrical experience in my short life. So,
David Ives is a playwright. You know him for All in the Timing and all of those great short plays. He continues to make new work that we're going to talk about in just a little bit. He is also represented on Broadway as the adapter of Is He Dead, written by Mark Twain. I wonder, as an adapter, do you get special access to the head of, say, Mark Twain? And if so, what was he really like?
Well, I speak to him quite frequently. He's actually out on the coast picketing for the writer's strike. I believe he's in front of Paramount today as we speak. The cigars are a real problem, I'll tell you that. You know, this collaboration was made very difficult because he does not adhere to stepping outside to smoke a cigar. So that was a problem. I can tell you that I don't know this for certain, but I believe that behind that thick, bushy mustache and that big cigar is a very nice girl named Lydia. And that there's some autobiographical element to this play that I don't even want to inquire about, but we never talked about it.
Well, cross-dressing is a big part of this play, and I wonder what it meant in 1898 to dress as a woman when you're a man versus today.
Well, I think one of the reasons why Twain thought that he could make some money on this was because he'd seen Charlie's Aunt, which was just a few years earlier and was the great, you know, sort of cross-dressing farce. I call this play a Twain's Vestite comedy, actually. But it's a naturally funny thing. It's funny in Some Like It Hot, and it's funny in Tootsie, and those are the two most popular film comedies ever made, according to a poll that I just recently
Tootsie
read.
Tootsie is one of the greatest movies ever. Oh, they're both are. Yeah, they are.
Yeah. And so there's something there that tickles people.
Was there a suggestion of homoeroticism when you dressed as a woman in 1898?
I would think that people wondered a little bit. What was interesting in this play is that there's a scene in the second act where the love interest is weirdly the love interest Marie is weirdly attracted to the widow, and
yes.
That scene is
in other words, her real lover dressed as a woman. She doesn't know it.
She doesn't know that it's her lover, but she is oddly attracted, and so there's a kind of crypto undercurrent there that is fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm. So why did this play not get produced when it was made?
It was not produced because Bram Stoker was supposed to produce it.
Bram Stoker of Dracula fame.
And Bram Stoker was actually a theater manager, and his warehouse burned down, and all the sets and costumes were destroyed, and so the play never went on. And Twain, as a playwright will, threw the play into a drawer in disgust and said, forget about it.
So it was merely mechanical like that? It wasn't that Millet was a sacred cow that couldn't be put up on the stage?
No. It was purely practical.
Mm. That was one of the suggestions in the play, Bill. I just... I'll let you know.
Who wrote that?
I guess there also was an issue of copyright with regard to this play. It was a touch-and-go situation there. It was found in 2002 as an important deadline approached, right?
I believe so. To tell you the truth, as a playwright, I'm not allowed to think about money or copyright, and so it's sort of beyond my ken.
Uh-huh. And so As I understand it, it was going to pass into the public domain, and there was just a few minutes left before it could be copyrighted. It was going to be the deadline was December 31st
and
of that year.
And so anybody could do
exactly.
this play. And so
that's
somebody
how I understand
somebody
it.
Got to the copyright office at midnight. It sounds like a Frank Capra movie with Gary Cooper on his way with Barbara Stanwyck trying to copyright a play.
Now, Jesse Green has written about this whole enterprise in the New York Times. He asks, is an interesting artifact of an earlier age, however flawed, best retooled for public consumption or left to the dusty file drawer of academic curiosity? In your opinion, David Ives, what do you think?
Well, I see no point in museum theater of any kind. I think that if a play isn't alive on its own, there's no point in doing it, no matter who wrote it. There are plenty of bad Shakespeare plays that don't get done, and they don't get done for a good reason. And so my true job was to do what every playwright's job is, which is to make it live and make it live for today. A play simply has to exist from moment to moment. And so if I didn't think that there was a viable, living, breathing, laugh-creating play here, I certainly never would have done this, because that would be against everything that I believe the theater ought to be.
So what is it about this play that you think elevates it above being a curiosity?
Well, I don't think that it's funny because it's Mark Twain. I think it's funny because it's funny. And it was partly my job to help make it a little more funny, perhaps, than it was originally. But I think theater has to be alive. And that's, the shelf life of plays is remarkably short. You know, a novel that's 10 years old is inevitably going to feel fresher than almost any play that's 10 years old or 10 weeks old. So what I was trying to do, too, was to create something that might last a little while.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the production process. Here you are dealing with a text that you've already decided is not sacred, so everything is up for grabs. Usually in the playmaking procedure, things happen as the result of rehearsals.
Things happen.
Mistakes are made.
Isn't that a description of theater? Mistakes are inevitably made. Well, in this case, we had Michael Blakemore, who is a god of the theater. I think Apollo, to tell you the truth, but he has created great theater in so many different genres: farce with Noises Off, and Democracy in Copenhagen in drama. And so, when Michael Blakemore said that he wanted to do this, which was quite early on in the whole process, it sort of bumped it up to a whole new level, because he simply knows how to do this better than just about anybody in the world. And so it was a great treat to work with him.
David Ives is my guest here on the Leonard LoPate Show. I am Dean Olscher, and we're talking about his work with Mark Twain's play, Is He Dead? Which I guess at one point you wanted to call I Am My Own Sister, which I thought was
unfair. I am my own dead sister, yes.
Now, we have in this play sort of probably an atypical example of what you do as an adapter of other works. You have been known for the Encore series of adapting great musicals, which I'm guessing is more about cutting than anything
else. Usually. Although older musicals at Encores, for example, from the 20s and 30s, they tend to need a little more facelifting than the later ones.
And so that's what you do. You find the bones, you find what works, you cut out the rest, mm-hmm. and constantly refresh this work. You also continue to write plays of your own, and as it happens, there is another one on right now, having to do with, of all people, Spinoza. I haven't seen this play. How funny is it?
It's pretty funny.
Uh-huh.
I have to say that it's a drama. It's a serious drama about the excommunication of Spinoza in 1656. But that doesn't mean that there isn't humor in it. And So I don't believe there's any such thing as a good play that doesn't have humor in it, because drama being life imitating the world has humor, therefore there's got to be some.
I wonder, though, I mean, Bob Denver was always Gilligan. Mm-hmm.
Are you suggesting him as Spinoza? That would be very interesting.
Will you have a hard time being known as the author of plays other than the All in the Timing collection and other things that can be serious?
Well, people seem to associate me with All in the Timing. But the thing is, I've had, a number of serious plays before this. But I think the thing to remember is that in All in the Timing, every one of those little plays was actually an idea. Mm. And I think of those plays as very serious. Mm. Three Monkeys typing Shakespeare. Trotsky with a mountain climber's axe in his head. These are little philosophical ideas. What does it mean to, what is the heart of creativity? What happens when you try to write Hamlet, or what happens when you've got a mountain climber's axe in your head? And so the leap from, let's say, Philip Glass buying a loaf of bread to Spinoza being excommunicated from the Jewish community in 1656 seems to me a very small leap.
I have to say that for me, the lesson of getting to know your work over the years has been this idea that we have of a split between the head and the heart is a false dichotomy. And that's what I appreciate most, is that you can laugh and you can also think smart thoughts and also feel deep things all in the same moment.
Well, for me, I go to the theater either to laugh or to cry. And if I can do both of those in one play, I'm doubly happy.
No. David Ives, thanks so much for being here with us today. You can check out David Ives on Broadway with Is He Dead, which was written by Mark Twain and adapted by David Ives. And then say the full title. It's New Jerusalem, The Interrogation of Baruch de Spinoza. Have I said it right?
At Baruch de Spinoza, at Talmud Torah Congregation, November 27, 1656.
Thanks again for joining us here on the Leonard LoPate Show.
Thank you.